Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Diana Deeney. Hi, Fred.
Hey. A second question from the same person, discussion earlier this week. First, she asked about, do you have enough data? And we spent a whole episode talking about that, and we probably could have talked for a lot longer on it.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, and it brought up a point to that reliability engineer isn't just doing equations and doing regression analysis and, you know, doing test data analysis or field failure analysis. It's really, that's a part of our job, but that's not what we do. It's a tool or a method that we use in our jobs. And so then she said, well, what does a reliability engineer do? Because in school, I'm learning about regression analysis and failure analysis and, you know, all of these, and that, oh, design for reliability means you have to do FMEAs and HALT and stuff like that. And I'm like, no, it's not that we do data analysis. That's a tool to what we really do. And she then said, well, what do you do? Mm-hmm. What does a reliability engineer do? Well, to be honest, as we were talking in the last episode, we do spend a lot of time dealing with data or trying to find it or create it or, you know, stuff like that. It is a part of what we do. Yet I had to think, sit back and think a little bit is, no, that's not why we get hired. You know, to be, if you're really, really good and you're influencing decisions and helping the team create a reliable product or system, the analysis part, dealing with data is part of that. Yet I think what we do is so much more than that. You know, what's your thought on that?
Yeah. So I was initially thinking, you know, that reliability engineers are problem solvers, but then we're also problem finders, which is why we get a bad rap. I think a lot of the time we're the bridge between different ideas and different groups of people who are trying to develop or maintain something. Mm-hmm. And we also offer that independent viewpoint because we're generally not directly the decision makers on how something's going to go.
Right.
But we can influence the decision makers based on the tools that we use and the data that we can collect. And that influence can have long-term big effects for customer satisfaction, for how much you can charge for a product, to how long it'll last in the field and how safe it is. Mm-hmm. It's an empowering position to have with a team of people that you can help them to make wise decisions about the things that are being developed.
Yeah. And that's the way I described it and it's the way Carl and I, when in the process of writing the book, The Process of Reliability, I got to get my shameless plug in there somewhere.
Yeah, sure.
But we had, I think, 5 steps to create a reliability plan, to create and implement a plan for, say, a new product development. It was really our target for the book. And we have lots of experience in those areas and stuff. And we're going through it. And we're getting done down to kind of pretty close to final drafts and getting feedback on it and everything else. And Carl and I met and, you know, something's missing. There's this step where we figure out, what do we work on? What's the priority? We go out and find, you know, what's keeping people up at night? What kind of issues do they think is going to happen? We do FMEAs, we do interviews, we do all kinds of stuff to figure out what could we work on, right? And that's a long list. It always is a longer list than any team can handle.
Yeah.
And I said, and then we write a plan. And say, this is what we're going to do. And I said, you know, there's something missing there because you and I can work with the team. And you too, Diana, is we work with teams and then we go, based on our experience and this, that thing, and what we've interpreted from all these gathering of info, Like, these are the important decisions. But we didn't write it that way. And so we said, we're missing that we're influencers of decisions. And so we need to prioritize by what's the most important decisions. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest impact things? What's most relevant for the people making those decisions? What level of granularity or investment is appropriate so that they get the information that they will use? It doesn't make any sense to give them a great ALT result, you know, 2 weeks too late or with so much detail in it that they said, I just needed to know if it would last a day or two, not 10 yeah. years. You know,
yeah.
you wasted a bunch of time there. So understanding the criteria to what is a good piece of information that they need. And so we added another chapter. So you need to understand the decisions. And that's part business. That's part what all the trade-offs are. What are all the moving parts that are influencing this? It could be regulatory. It could be time to market. It could be technology, inventions, you know, all kinds of, can we manufacture it or not? It, which ties into what you talked about. We're often the bridge because we work with marketing and sales and design and manufacturing and vendors and on and on and on. Whereas a mechanical engineer works with other mechanical engineers and might say, all right, electrical guys, how big is your circuit board? Where do you think you want to, you know, put it in this device? All right, that's too big, make it smaller. And that's their whole interaction with this other team.
Yeah,
where the screws are, you know, here's where we're going to attach it. You guys design around it. They really, most engineering teams work in a silo and do some interfacing with other components and other teams. But we're working closely with electrical. We're working closely with mechanical. We're working closely with software sometimes. And we're working closely with marketing and the warranty policy people and the manufacturing teams and so on. So we often have a unique view of the overall product that very few other people do.
Yeah. And the users too, the potential users of the product and mm-hmm. our customers, that all ties into that too.
Well, I learned this more in my quality type training and background and stuff, is that we're also an advocate for the customer. Is that,
yeah,
you know, it's got to work in their environment. I see that's where we do the most of it, is saying, well, what's the day in the life of our product in a customer's hands? And we can go to marketing and other folks to try to get more info on that, or customer service, those kinds of teams, field service. But is this going to be put on the shelf and used once a month very delicately? Or is it going to be a handheld device and left on the dashboard of your car in Arizona in the summer?
Yeah.
Where is this thing going to actually be and how is it going to be used? Because it really does impact reliability. And so we need to know those things. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, the customer really needs this to work for 10 years with very low failure rate because it's important to their business. When it fails, it costs them millions. You know, we replace it for $1,000, but it costs them $1 million. That's not good for brand promise or customer retention or these other things. So let's figure out, you know, the investment that's appropriate so that they get what they're looking for. I don't know if that explains what we do on a day-to-day basis. You could say, as I ran into one senior manager, he says, so you just told us this is important. This is what your role is in the organization and why that's important. I get that. But what's your calendar look like? What do you do day-to-day, hour-to-hour? And he says, well, let's see. He opened up his calendar he had with him and he said, I spent 3 hours this week trying to figure out where my secretary is going to sit and, you know, what building and what staff I have and where's this group going to move to. And I spent time trying to recruit, you know, three more people. And he went through this whole week and I said, did any of that week spend actually move forward any of your priorities that you just told us were the most important things? And he looked at me like, oh, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do.
What was his role again?
He was like a procurement manager or something like that. Okay. And it was, did you actually spend time on the things? And I asked every one of the managers that came through this class I was taking in the company. There was like 10 or 12 of us that were being given this overview of what the corporate roles were and what all these different jobs were and all this other stuff. And I got a reputation real quick after the third one showed up and I asked them the same question. So you just told us what's important. What do you actually do what's on your calendar? How much time do you spend doing what you think is the most important thing? And most of them just spent a whole bunch of time doing urgent things. And I relate that because as a reliability engineer, it is very, very easy to spend time on urgent stuff. You know, we just had a failure, or the customer called and said there's a failure and we have to investigate it and everything else. And sometimes, yeah, that's the right thing to do. Yet I think a good amount of what we do really should be focused on what's important is, do we have systems in place and procedures and cultural things that says we're going to prevent failures? Or how do we systematically set up a set of guardrails so that we balance the needs of customers' expectations around reliability with cost or with time to market or other things? It's not okay to rush a product out the door and say, we'll fix it later. And yeah, some organizations, that's how they operate. But what's really important is that we fix that. We identify it, and that's a hurdle, and that's why we're having 5% field failure rates instead of 1% like our competitors. Let's get it right and not prioritize the urgent stuff at the expense of the important stuff.
So you mentioned the project manager, mm-hmm, and managers. So even if, you know, there's a development manager or a leader, somebody that's, mm-hmm, managing the project, and then there's the functional managers in a business who are, mm-hmm, the leaders in the mechanical engineering department.
Right.
So being managers, they do have to manage things. They have to manage people, timelines, which projects they're going to be working on. And that's, yeah, not really the kind of things that reliability engineers get into. So I think that's there's a bit of a gray, blurry line there. It's not like a straight cutoff. But reliability engineers, are more concerned with the products being developed, how they perform, and the customers that they're supposed to be performing for, mm-hmm, and how all of those interfaces work together to make sure that that happens.
Right.
And that we're not really the management. I mean, we do get concerned about, like you said, costs and timelines. Those are always going to influence decisions, including reliability engineering decisions. But they're inputs into the kind of recommendations that we make. It's not we're not setting the limits, so to say. Maybe I'm not saying that quite right.
Well, it's take, for example, a consumer, you know, product that has a seasonal sales. So if you're not on the shelves before the holidays or before back to school or whatever is your product's niche and what seasonality it occurs, if you're not on the shelf, it doesn't sell. So it's a really expensive, and I'm thinking of like back to school sales for whatever device you're making. If it doesn't sell then, it's not going to sell in September and October if it didn't sell in August, because, mm-hmm, everybody got it and they got it from somebody else if you weren't there. So time to market was absolutely critical for some products I've worked with.
Yeah. Yep.
Yet in reliability, if we go in with the argument, well, we need to lower the field failure rate and here's the warranty benefit and everything else, and if that even smelled like or just had the hint that it might risk delaying the product's launch and production, is a non-starter. It's just,
yeah,
deaf ears. Where if you go in and say, if we identify the latent defects or problems early in the program, it's much, much easier to fix them and reduces the risk to delaying the program. Then they go, oh, tell me more. So I think some of that influence part of what we do is understanding the business priorities, understanding the management constraints and priorities and trade-offs. And I like to think of it as use it against them, but it's use it with them so that they can make good reliability decisions and meet their business goals and department objectives and stuff like that.
Yes. And then there's all those interfaces, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And those interfaces usually come with conflict. And that doesn't mean that people are like yelling at each other and slamming the table with a red face. sometimes, you know, it could be a healthy conflict, but those need to be managed. And yeah. I think reliability engineers manage a lot of conflict in that way. And I'm not talking about like the HR conflict where two people are having an argument.
Yeah, they just don't like each other.
But. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I ran into one where his electrical engineer had a component that is going to need to be shielded, but it needed a metallic shield on the board. And it's a complex component with all kinds of traces coming off it. And it was using all the space around it. So how do you put a little can around just that? And the mechanical guy is like, I'm bending tin. This is not difficult, but the electrical people won't tell me where to attach it to the board. I need a through hole in four places to make this work and electrical connections under it. And they actually worked about 20 feet from each other. But neither one of them would walk over to the other person's office. And all right, I hear both of them complaining. So I booked a conference room, like a neutral territory, and pulled them both in there and said, what are our options? How do we make this work? And it was done in 5 minutes. You know, once they both understood each other's sets of constraints and trade-offs, they're like, oh, okay, well, we know we got to do it, but... It was like, oh, they don't understand mechanics. And the other one was, oh, they don't understand electronics. Like, I don't care. We need to put it on there. Let's just make it happen. Having a box of donuts there also helped. I don't think they would have showed up otherwise.
But, you know, sometimes people think, well, that's the project manager's role. But right. I see reliability engineers, you know, stepping into that role quite a bit just because that's where you're needed. Because you're yep. that independent point of view person that's on the project that can provide that for them, that can yeah. help them work through those kind of problems.
So in answering this question for when I got asked this, we influence people. And a lot of the same stories we're talking about were some of the examples I used. And she said, we don't learn about how to work with people in our classwork, in our background. Engineers don't know how to work with people. To be a really good, effective reliability engineer, and I'd say most any engineering position, is that, yeah, you're not doing this alone. You need to work with people in order to influence them. They have to know who you are and trust you. And that doesn't happen because you made a beautiful cumulative distribution function plot. It's part of it. You got to be good at what you do and know the technical aspects of it. You also need to know mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, software engineering, industrial engineering, manufacturing engineering, and on and on and on in order to talk in their language. And I think at that point she was rethinking her career choices.
But that's what makes it so interesting and fun, honestly.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Totally. It's working with other people to influence their decisions. And I think it hinges on that idea that, yeah, we're often not the decision maker. We don't sit at the final table going up or down and saying, yeah, ship it or don't ship it. We're rarely in that kind of position. And I think rightfully so, there's so many other factors at play that we should be aware of, but we're not the one saying, I've got vague data from customers, from marketing, from manufacturing, from the supply chain scenarios that's going on, what's going to happen with tariffs. And we've got to make a decision whether we ship this product or not. I'm glad I'm not the one doing that. Yet I get to add information to hope add some clarity, at least around the reliability part, that say, yeah, we're clearly there for this area of that decision, or we're not. And here's the trade-offs. But I'm not influencing, well, what's the expected market share, and trying to forecast how many millions of dollars of parts that we need to start assembling, you know, to do that. I'm not that decision maker.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, it is, you know, we do data analysis. There's no doubt about it. And in various forms and ways, and we run tests, and we do failure analysis, and we do FMEAs, and we advise teams on how to design in reliability versus not, and help them set up things like that. We spot problems that we can step in and help solve, like the example I gave with this can for radiation suppression from this component. But all of that is part of working with other people. And I think that's a big part of what we do. We bring expertise, and we bring a voice of the customer type stuff to it. Yet, if you're not working with other people, it's for naught. You can do a great report, but nobody will read it. You're not a reliability engineer in my mind.
Yeah. And as far as the things that she's learning in school, mm-hmm. about, you know, the analyses and stuff, that's all a really good foundation, so that when you are making recommendations, you're confident in your own recommendations.
Yeah.
You're confident that you did the right analysis, or that you had the right data, or that the data that you have is telling you this story. So those are important things to learn about.
Definitely.
For reliability engineering. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be solid in the things that we uniquely do, like creating reliability analysis, or even trying to teach somebody else how to do it. We need a solid foundation in it. I think that's less than half our job, though, to be effective.
Yes.
Yeah. Spend way more time working with other folks. So that's what we do day to day. And I'm glad we don't have to worry about who sits where, and, you know, so-and-so is late for work, and all the management considerations. There's too many really good engineers that get promoted, I use that term loosely, to management, and then we lose their talent. You know, some turn out to be great engine managers, but others they should have stayed in engineering.
What's that called? The Peter principle?
Yeah. You get promoted to you get promoted to your level of incompetence.
Have you ever known anyone that was presented with a promotion from engineering to manager, and they said, "No, thanks. I'm like being in my engineering role."
Well, I did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. My boss was all upset with me. Then she said, "Well, how about I promote you as an engineer?" And I said, "In the way the pay structure was, I would take like an 8% pay cut." And I did the math with her, and it was going to be 8 years, even if I was at the higher tier, it'd be 8 years before I made that up. And I said, "Well, is there anything I can do different with this other level of pay, or this other title, an engineer one to engineer two, or whatever the nomenclature was?" And he goes, "No, you can do everything you're doing now and more now. There's no barriers on who you can work with or who you can talk to because of your job title." I says, "Yeah, I thought so. So why would I want to take a pay cut to get promoted?" And it was one of her goals to get two of us promoted. And she was kind of looking at me like, "Please don't tell anybody else this logic." I said, "There's something fundamentally wrong with our system here. If I work at the next level,
yeah, uh-huh.
I get a great pay raise at my existing level. If I accept the promotion, I'm at the bottom of the pool, and I'll get a very small one because I'm competing against all these other people at that level, and they've been there for a couple of years." So the pattern was that you would get a very small pay raise. And switching to manager was, and I was working on nobody wanted to manage me. It was There's lots of reasons for that.
I think that might, would that be another episode?
That's a whole other episode.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it was an experiment in the group, and we got funded to do this extra side project, myself and Mike. And we had, between the two of us, a quarter of a man week or whatever. We had like 4 hours that we, to between the two of us, we're supposed to devote to the program. And we ended up spending way more time on it, up to the point where our director, and we went through a couple of managers in the team, and they were just more babysitters. And, you know, if we had a question about whatever, but they didn't know what we were doing, and they didn't even want to know what we were doing. And my director, after a couple of years of working independently, she said, why don't you just be a self-managed team? Let's try that. And so we did that for a couple of years. And then she came by my desk one day and said, am I running this department or are you? And I was like, you are, I think. And she says, 3/4 of the projects that this group of 50 engineers are working on that work for me, you brought in and directed. You know, this experiment you and Mike have been doing for the last couple of years is growing. And now you basically got half this team pretty much doing projects that you brought in or created or work with our clients to bring in and stuff like that. And I says, that's my job. I said, oh, sorry. He says, all right, which one of you want to be the manager? And Mike and I looked at each other. I'm not managing him. I'm not managing him. I don't want to be a manager. And he was the consummate scientist and I was the consummate engineer. So we were just, and she said, all right, go find a manager, somebody that you're willing to work for. because I can't, you guys are doing so much that you really need somebody to do the bookkeeping and travel and salary and all the other stuff that, you know, we got to have some oversight because you're so influential in the group. And I don't have time to do that as much as I'd like to.
I was going to say, why didn't she want to do it?
Well, she also had 50 engineers to work with, not just the two of us. Oh,
that's a lot. Yeah.
You know, and had, I think, 5 managers working for her that did, you know, but then it's managing them and department strategies and alignments and everything else. And she said, I'd love to work with you guys closer because it's, you're doing amazing stuff and it's really great. Go hire a manager. So we were charged with go hire our boss. But I didn't want to be a manager.
I'd like to hear more about that, but I think
another day.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be another day. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, let's cut it off there. You know, if you're, I think we already did sign off at one point, but yeah, if you were offered a promotion because you're such a wonderful reliability engineer, you know, what'd you do? Because it might work out just fine. It may not. It really depends on the organization and culture and stuff like that. But it's worth talking about some more. So we should do that. Anyway, get in touch. These are a couple of questions. This episode and the last one were a couple of questions from one person. So it was gave you something to think about and hopefully it's something for you to consider in your own role. So let us know how it's going.
And you mentioned your book at the top of the show. What's the title of it and where can people find it?
The Process of Reliability Engineering, and you can get it at most bookstores carry it in one form or another. I haven't ever seen it on a shelf, so I don't know if it's actually in the store, but online and Amazon certainly has it, and that's where most of our sales come from.
Okay.
But by Carl S. Carlson and myself. So we had a lot of fun writing it.
Sounds great. It was always nice catching up, Fred, as always. Same.
Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon, I'm sure. Take care, Diana.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.